the North Star for me is just seeing what it was that my mom went through due to her brain not working the way that it should have been working.
Greatest Stories Never Told, fam. You are in for a very special treat today. We have one of my dearest friends, Max Lugavir, in the motherfucking house. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, Genius Foods. He has been on Dr. Oz more times than anyone besides Dr. Oz himself. He's been on the Rachel Ray Show a dozen times. You've probably seen him on The Doctors. The guy's everywhere. He's blowing up. He's like the health guru of our generation. And his next book, Genius Life, is coming out soon, which we're going to drop into today. Max, thanks for being here, my man.
Dude, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
What an honor.
The honor is mine. And for the folks at home, it's going to be ours, because this is going to be good. Because Max told me before this started that nothing was off limits. We can talk about anything I want to ask. So,
kind of nervous.
So, you know, as you should be, man. All right, so I want to start out going way back. If you were to have a homosexual experience, who would it be? Would it be Elvis or Brad Pitt? I'm just kidding. You don't have to answer that question.
Okay. I was thinking about it.
Okay. I saw your head
gears
spinning.
Returning.
Yeah. Okay. No, thanks for being here, Max. This is going to be so much fun because you and I are great friends. We're always joking around. Actually, when I went on your podcast, I was like, I don't know. I was like, man, I must sound like such a prick to everyone that doesn't know how good of friends Max and I are. And I probably do right now, just pulling out the gate with that question. But anyway, Max, man, it's been amazing to see you come up, but let's take them back. You know, what were you like in high school or childhood, or where'd you grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in New York City.
In the city?
I grew up in the city.
Was that like gangster shit, man? Because I used to live in New York City, and I was like, I don't know if I want to raise kids here, because I saw that movie Kids.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Where the kids are like smoking crack at age 10. And
just, yeah.
You know.
There was definitely that, and I was sort of on the outskirts of it. But I was able to kind of perceive that adjacently through kids that I was friends with.
Okay.
But I was never... you know, I never really got to see that side of New York.
Have you ever smoked a cigarette?
Yeah. High school.
Like, more than once, or just like, cause all the kids, other kids are doing it.
In high school. Yeah. More than once.
Okay. When was the first time you, smoked a marijuana cigarette?
Also in high school.
High school. Okay. So that's a normal age, I guess.
Fast.
Okay.
New York, yeah.
That's normal age. I was thinking you would say like 8. You know, being in New York City.
Yeah.
Okay, no. When was the first time you did crack cocaine?
Never.
Okay, all right. So, you know. Now, was it a life of crime?
It was not a lot. Yeah. I got in trouble once in school because I would, me and my best friend, male friend and best female friend, we were very close. We were almost inseparable in third grade. Mm. And my third grade teacher, for anybody who... got an A on a test or did really well that week in school, that she would give out these little toy prizes. They were basically like McDonald's Happy Meal style prizes.
Okay.
Like little small, you know, trinkets.
That was the best when teachers would do that.
Yeah, they would give out these prizes.
Yeah.
But me and my two friends would, for a little while, we would go up after class. We knew that she would bring the class down to dismissal to get picked up, and she would wait there. And me and my friends would go up, and we learned that she would not lock her door, and so we would sneak in back into her room, and we would steal a bunch of like prizes. And
from the nicest teacher.
Yeah. She wasn't the nicest teacher. I feel like the toys, in a way, were kind of a compensatory mechanism.
Interesting.
But I got in trouble.
But you were still a dick.
I was still a dick. Me and my friend. Okay. Well, yeah, we would steal these toys. We would load up our backpacks with them, and I remember that I came home once, and my mom was going through my backpack to make sure that I had like the homework in that I needed before the weekend, and she saw all these like things in there, and she asked me where I'd gotten them from. And I've never been a good liar, which I think is one of the reasons why I ended up down the career path that I ended up down. Like, honesty and truth are really important to me. And so when my mom asked me where I had gotten all these like toys, you know, I think I probably had said something along the lines of like I had taken them from somewhere, and she tried to get the truth out of me because, you know, truth was very important in my household. To be a liar in my house growing up was the worst name you could be called. And so I would never ever lie to my mom or anybody in my family. And I ended up telling her somehow that, or she figured out somehow that we had stolen the things that were in my bag, and she ended up calling my school and letting my school know, and it got me in trouble.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
She wanted me to, I mean, discipline,
yeah,
you know, is important. She would read me Aesop's Fables growing up. Mm. And one of those fables, I don't know if your audience is familiar with it, but it's like a book of sort of childhood stories, and every story at the end.
I think everyone knows Aesop's, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child. I mean, thankfully my parents were not, I think that they struck a balance pretty well. But anyway, she wanted to make sure that I got what was owed to me for that, or what I deserved for that.
Yeah.
For doing that.
Wow.
Stealing is not good.
Yeah. I remember I was at a grocery store with my mom, and I'd ride underneath the grocery cart. You know, the cart's got that thing where you can put like a heavy case of water.
Yeah.
I would sit on that. And we went by that candy bin, and there was like a candy that had fallen out, and I took it and put it in my pocket. And my mom, when she saw me with it, drove us back to the store and made me go up to the manager and be like, hey, I stole this. Like, here it is back.
That's amazing. Yeah. I know your mom. She's a sweet lady.
Yeah. It sounds like our parents had something in common.
Yeah.
You know, making us pay for our sins. Yeah. Or at least fess up. Yeah.
Exactly.
So, first bank robbery, how old were you?
First bank robbery, no, never robbed a bank.
Okay, so what was the teenage years like, though? Was that, you know, New York City, you basically can go around on your own without having to have a driver's license.
Yeah.
In California, age of 16 is when you start getting into some shit, you know, or like at least when one of your friends is, because then you can drive around.
Yeah.
But New York, you've got all that public transportation, so you can go anywhere, right?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, you're pretty much confined to your home or wherever your parents would drive you when you're anywhere but New York City.
Right.
But yeah, so I was able to kind of go around and take the bus. I would take the bus a lot to visit my friends, and I would hang out with them at their houses and go to the park. And I grew up going to public school my whole life. So I was, you know, I was able to, and I went to schools where for my elementary school, I was in the gifted program, but there was, you know, it was a normal school. And so I ended up having friends that, were from all different, really walks of life, you know, intellectual capacity, however you want to measure that in children. I don't know. It's, you know,
yeah,
probably a controversial idea, but also across the socioeconomic spectrum as well, because my school is a public school. So I became friends with people of all, you know, different backgrounds, races, everything from very, very early on. I was very blessed to have had that exposure, you know.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. High school, I went to a school that was a little bit more selective. So it was the whole high school. It was a tiny, tiny high school.
Like how big is tiny?
Like my graduating class, we had 120 kids.
Okay.
If that.
Okay. And let's see. So it was like they selected certain people to go there?
Yeah.
But it wasn't private, but you had to like apply to get in or something? Or?
Yes. It was, I think it's called a charter school. I'm not super familiar with the terminology, obviously, because I was a little kid when I went through it.
But they're like, this guy's really handsome. Let's bring him in.
Just that.
Okay.
Basically.
Got it.
No, you had to test to get in, and I got in, you know, and which is interesting because my grades were never great all throughout my schooling.
Okay.
I always struggled to get good grades, but I always had like a lot of potential. You know, the teachers always saw potential in me. And I think it's because I've always been a very curious person. I would always ask good questions. So even though I wasn't able to win teachers over with my grades, I was always able to win them over with my curiosity about things and the fact that I was always like open and interested in learning.
Were you interested in health back then?
Not at all.
Like, did you want to be a doctor or anything like that ever?
I became interested in health in high school.
Okay.
When you were deciding
whether or not to smoke that cigarette or?
Yeah. That was purely the result of peer pressure and, you know, kids do stupid things. I did plenty of stupid things growing up. But yeah, I had a friend who was an exchange student. He was in from France, smoked a lot of cigarettes. Hanging out with him all the time.
They like probably hand out cigarettes at the high school of France.
Right? high school in France, yeah.
Like, here's your baguette.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, he, so, you know, thankfully I didn't smoke that many, you know. But yeah, I mean, I definitely got to experience like what is so addictive about them and what's so enjoyable about them. And that. And I grew up, my dad was always a smoker. He still is a smoker.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So I kind of grew up around cigarettes. And
did he smoke in the house?
Did he smoke in the house?
Yeah.
He used to. Yeah. My mom would always yell at him.
Oh wow.
So it wasn't. He didn't do it. He didn't do it frequently.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, he smoked in the house. He would always smoke in the car and leave the window open. And my mom would always yell at him for making us inhale that secondhand smoke.
Oh,
so
man.
I grew up with that. And then so it makes a lot of sense that I would have tried it, but it also makes a lot of sense that I really have dedicated my life towards, you know, being on the other side of the coin and exploring health, because I mean, cigarettes are horrible for you.
Yeah. So let's talk about your hair.
Okay.
You told me in high school you had a big epiphany.
Yeah.
Was it someone made a comment to you, or what was it? This story blew my mind.
Wow, what a memory you have. You're eating those genius foods.
That's right.
Yeah. So I was pretty nerdy in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I was definitely not. I was like as far away from being the good-looking guy in high school as you could be. I had a big poof. I call it a Jufro. I'm Jewish, so I can say that.
But you can say like, I can't.
Yeah, it was like a big poof. I would slick it back, and I was kind of modeling what my dad would do with his hair.
Okay.
But there was also a phase when I would blow dry it too, and it would just get like really puffy.
Mm.
And I also had some baby fat. I wasn't an athlete at all. I wasn't like, you know, working out at the time. I had braces, and I was a big computer nerd. And in tandem with that, my style was really kind of interesting. So growing up in New York, there were a lot of kids that looked really cool. Like the hip hop, you know, kids would always wear like these brands like Tommy Hilfiger,
yeah,
and Perry Ellis and all these like cool brands, right? That in retrospect, what I've learned is they would get them from like outlet stores and they would look like really cool.
Oh, okay.
My mom, when I told my mom that I wanted to start wearing those brands, she would take me to Bloomingdale's, and we would go and we would shop, and she would get me all this like, I mean, God bless my mom, I love her so much. She would get me all this like really high end like designery looking clothing, like t-shirts that were a little more tight fitting and
like expensive
like
stuff.
Yeah, like fairly expensive stuff. And so I would wear this like oddly high fashion kind of stuff. Not high fashion, but just like, you know, designer stuff. I was wearing like designer stuff with this poof back hair, braces, baby fat.
Yeah.
So I just
Just Dolce & Gabbana from the neck down.
Yeah, Dolce & Gabbana from the
fall winter collection.
Yeah, the fall winter collection. Needless to say, like, the clothing that I was wearing was not the cool clothing.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like the baggy jeans and like the cool time. It was like a little more, you know, fashion-y, I guess.
Okay. So did people try to steal it, or it was just, this is like,
I just like kind of stood out. Like I wasn't dressed.
Well, so what was the hair epiphany?
So the hair epiphany was, so at a certain point, I kind of realized I was spending a lot of time at the beach. So my parents also, I was very privileged in the sense that my parents, we also had a house at the eastern tip of Long Island. And so I started spending a lot of summers at the beach, and I started spending more time with the kids in that area. So this is high school. I was 16. I was able to get my driver's license early. So my dad got me a car. I had a Jeep, and I started spending time with some kids that were not from my high school, but more like local kids from like the beach town that I was spending like summers in.
Okay.
And I started to, and also my smoking French friend, he was a surfer and a skateboarder. And so I started to pick up some like style cues from him. So my wardrobe started to change a little bit. I started to get more into like surf brands and things like that.
Okay.
And so I started to dress a little bit better. The hair epiphany came when I was hanging out with a friend in high school. Her name's Casey. And I remember so distinctly, we were in gym class, and there was like a water fountain in gym class. And this was at the time when like the Backstreet Boys were popular, and sort of that look my hair was like, you know, kind of slick back at the time. She took me over to the water fountain, put water in her hands, ran her fingers through my hair, and then instead of like slicking it back, she pushed it forward.
Okay.
And she did that kind of like flip thing.
Okay.
That's really common. And that was the first time in my life I'd ever deviated from that like slick back hair thing. I'd worn it that way since I was like 7, you know, trying to emulate my dad. And I looked in the mirror and it looked really good. And the girls started, you know, because that hairstyle was kind of like in, the girls all kind of like, you know, they corroborated that it was like a good look for me. And they were like, you should wear your hair like that. And I was like, all right, well, if you say so.
Your entire life changed.
Entire life changed.
With the move of hair.
Yeah, with the move of hair. The hair instead started to go forward.
And look at you now.
And look at me now.
Just rocking it on, you know, millions of screens around the world.
It hasn't really, I mean, it's deviated a little bit since since then, but
it's looking good today.
Yeah. I mean, I like to keep it short. Yeah. I actually don't like to think about my hair. I once shaved my head.
Oh, wow.
Completely, yeah. Wow.
So, 5 Backstreet Boys, which one is your favorite?
Oh, man, I couldn't tell you. But I did always like Backstreet Boys over NSYNC. And I actually...
Me too.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like their songs
but
a lot better.
But I'm a huge JT fan.
Are you?
I am.
I mean, he's a talented guy.
He's fucking hilarious, actually, too. If you see him in interviews and stuff, he's a really funny guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the rest of the NSYNC guys never really did it for me.
Yeah.
But I thought Backstreet Boys, like, as a group, just had that mojo, you know?
Yeah. 1,000%. And I thought their songs were better.
Yeah. And I used to get, like, made fun of slash... It was coming from a guy. It was a make fun of thing. It was coming from a girl. It was a good thing. But I had the, like, hair not too different than I have now, but it was a lot blonder.
Hmm.
So I looked like...
A Backstreet
Boy. I can't remember if it's Aaron Carter or Nick Carter, but it's one of those guys that's in the Backstreet Boys. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. You and I both, we would have looked, you know.
We could have been in a boy band had we known each other back then. How old are you now?
37.
37. Okay. So I would have been a little bit senior, but, you know.
Yeah. You got to appease all grades, you know.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah. I agree.
Damn. Damn. You know, they say you're never too old to start a boy band. So.
I know. There you go. I mean, music is a huge interest of mine, like next to health.
Were you playing music back then? Because you play the guitar now and you just jumped on the piano and you don't even know how to play piano, but it sounded really good.
Thank you.
Were you playing guitar back then?
I was not. I was friends with musicians and I was always envious of their skills. And I tried to take up music once or twice when I was in high school, but I just didn't have the patience or attention span, you know, for it. And so,
Okay, got it. Okay, so... You're in high school, 16, 17 years old. You're rolling around in a Jeep wearing Dolce & Gabbana from the neck down, hair slicked forward, smoking cigarettes with your French buddy. What next? I mean, where do you go from there?
Where do you go from there?
When you're at the top, it's like there's only so many places you can go.
Yeah, so I at that point, it started to bring me a little bit out of my shell as a computer nerd. So prior to that,
were you like programming and stuff? Oh wow!
That's I was actually really featured on a TV show That's called amazing. In the Mix as a young prodigy, as a young web savvy
like
programming.
Doogie Howser of computers.
Kind of, yeah. I was. Yeah, I was on.
You were actually good at this.
I could have been like a Zuckerberg type. Like,
You don't fuck with computers at all now, do you?
Well, the thing is, all of those skills that I'd learned early on have now become integral to what I currently do for work. So it's actually funny that they've all come back to me. So even as a young kid, I taught myself, I became actually like expert level in HTML, they didn't have CSS at the time. These are all like web development technologies. And I also at the time became proficient at Photoshop, which had just launched when I was in high school.
Okay.
Did they
have Snapchat back then? Because you could Photoshop, make yourself look bigger below the pants.
Yes.
Okay.
You can in Photoshop.
Yeah. Yeah. What was your motivation for getting so good at Photoshop? Because that's usually why
I became a web designer. I was a self-taught.
It wasn't to like give yourself pectoral muscles or anything like that.
Have you
ever Photoshopped a picture to make yourself look more like ripped in the chest?
Never.
Okay.
Never. Yeah. Never.
Put it on something.
Yeah. Especially now in the era of Instagram. But but no, back then I was trying to like create graphics and I was developing websites both. Personally, I made a fan site for, my favorite band at the time, growing up.
Backstreet Boys?
Not Backstreet Boys. My favorite band, which continues to be my favorite band of all time, the band Live. So I made a fan site
for
them.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you feel about Kings of Leon?
Not a big fan.
Kind of like a Live ripoff, huh?
Oh, man, not even. I mean.
Okay, what about... Wait, now I'm blanking on the name. The band that everyone talks shit about. Nickelback.
Oh my God, no. Definitely not.
So I actually think Nickelback's amazing.
You do?
Yes. Oh. I was thinking, like, why does everyone talk shit about Nickelback? And so I went, this is just a few weeks ago, I started listening to their songs.
I did too, actually.
And they're really good.
After the Trump thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like Photograph and, you know, it's really good music, actually.
Yeah.
And they've sold tens of millions of albums. So I think the thing, like, people just talk shit about Nickelback because talking shit on Nickelback is cool, but, like, Nickelback actually fucking rocks.
They're good.
They're good.
Yeah. Yeah. There was definitely a Nickelback song that was on regular repeat when I was in college. It was, I think, the song Breathe. That was a really good song.
Yeah.
I also, there were a few Creed songs that I really liked.
Yeah.
I was obsessed
nice voice with that singer Creed.
Scott Stapp, yeah. I was obsessed with like kind of that genre. Always a big music fan. I get that from my mom too. I get
a lot
from
my mom. So you're computer programming, you're into music, you're smoking cigarettes. So what happened after high school? Did you go to college?
Yeah.
Okay.
So halfway through, so my French friend.
Wait. Oh, this is going to be good. I can tell this is going to be good. Okay, go.
He left after 10th grade. I told you he was like an exchange student.
Back to France?
Student. Yeah.
Oh,
back
shit. To France.
So from 11th grade on, something changed in me where I became really interested in health and fitness. And that was really, that along with music became my, were my primary interests through the end of high school. I've talked
were
about
you like working out yourself?
I began working out. Yeah.
Okay.
So
any type of sports or just in the gym?
No, I've always been terrible at sports.
Last
picked on like, you know, high school basketball teams and things like that. I was not on any formal teams, but yeah, terrible at sports. I was a computer nerd and I was like, you know, I started gaining an interest in like, I became interested in girls and things like that, but I was still a computer programmer. So it was sometime in the 11th grade where I stumbled into a supplement store by my school in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan, mm-hmm. where there was a guy behind the counter who was really knowledgeable. And I saw these supplements and these potions and tonics and powders on the wall as being a potential sort of out from my like kind of scrawny, not super in shape self, and as a way to get stronger, make myself feel more confident, bulk up a little bit, gain some muscle. I was really into superheroes at the time too, so that idealized male form, you know, like
mm-hmm.
abs, pecs, that whole thing. I was like, I could have that too if I like just take a few powders that are on the wall.
Yeah, and they usually like make the superhero like subtly, they'll make his junk look really big.
Will they?
Seriously.
Wow,
yeah. They call it the cod piece.
The cod piece.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the idealized male. They say that men don't have body image like pressure to live up to.
Dude, yeah, no one's ever opened up a Batman comic.
Right? Yeah, they're all jacked.
They've
got cod pieces.
Yeah.
So in tandem with discovering like supplements, I started to work out. I joined a gym in New York Sports Club by my apartment in New York. And I really started to dedicate myself to fitness and working out. And I was reading a lot. The guy in the supplement store gave me some literature to read.
Mm.
I've only later realized that a lot of that literature is basically supplement marketing, but at the same time, it made me very interested in the topic, so I can't, hate on it for that. I started engaging with news groups on the internet, which is what they were called at the time, news groups.
Definitely, I was in some of those.
Yeah, it was like alt.fitness, alt.bodybuilding. So I became really interested in bodybuilding, and, you know, a lot of the people who are even though I didn't ultimately go into fitness as a profession necessarily, a lot of the hardcore like fitness names that you'll see, sort of floating around in the fitness space, I've been familiar with for 20 years. Mm. You know, so very early adopter of all this stuff.
Okay, so you glazed over the women part. You talked about the hair. How old were you when you lost your virginity?
18.
And was it direct, really relatable to the hair? Was it because the hair changed and then you just couldn't bat them off? Because it didn't sound like you wearing those designer clothes was doing much for you.
Yeah, no. I mean, I definitely, my style changed. I got rid of the designer clothes. And, you know, as ridiculous as that sounds, that was like just my mom's way of getting me, you know, trying to make me fit in more.
It's great. I mean, it's great that she was doing that. My mom used to make clothes for me when I was in like second grade, third grade.
Amazing.
She'd like sew me some shorts and I remember she made maybe shorts with sharks on them because I love sharks.
No, but it actually is something that, like, you know, as a kid, you kind of fixate on your insecurities and you wonder why. So I always wondered, like, my mom was buying me all these, like, brand name things, why I didn't look as cool as the guy with great style who's wearing. And it literally came to me, like, in my 30s that a lot of those kids were buying their stuff from, like, the outlets, you know, and they were just kind of like, they fit them differently. And they weren't, like, this, like, sort of high couture stuff that like only is sold at Bloomingdale's, which is where my mom would take me to shop. I was very lucky, and my mom, spared no expense, you know, and trying to make me happy. So,
yeah. So was 18 an older age in New York City? Because I saw that movie Kids, man, and they were like, you know.
No, they were younger. They were younger. There were a lot of kids in New York that would hang out in like the public parks and would do a lot of drugs. I mean, the drug that I think was by far the most common was weed. So yeah. It wasn't really crack or anything. Like, I didn't even see, growing up, I didn't see cocaine. I didn't see crack or anything like that. But there was a lot of weed. There was a lot of weed smoking. And I learned from a very early age, I mean, I've talked about this publicly on my podcast before, that weed and my brain never worked well. So right off the bat, there was a block. I would never hang out with those kids because I hated always the way weed made me feel.
I had the same thing. But then when I started going to parties, and I liked drinking beer, but beer was expensive. And my friends would be able to smoke weed and go to the party without having to buy beer and save a lot of money. And I was like, you know, if I could get used to being social with weed, not have to buy beer, I'd save a lot of money. So I committed to smoking weed every day for 30 days. And I got to where I could, like, you know, go to the store and, like, you know, drive a car, and I was terribly unsafe all the time. But I never got to where I wouldn't have social anxiety. I could never go to a party when I was stoned.
Yeah.
Even after the 30-day experiment.
Oh, man. I would not. I mean, I could be around my best friends. And the minute I get THC in my body, I just want to retreat and go home.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here.
That's it. Yeah. Like, it just does not. But it's a weird thing. Like, I don't know if it's a genetic, if there's a genetic component. But, like, I've known throughout my life people who are very high performers, very social. They sort of, you know, they butterfly, they bloom, like, when they're high on marijuana.
Bunch of them. I know, like, CEOs that smoke weed every day.
Yeah. And so, and I just, it's, my experience with it is so diametrically opposed that, like.
Yeah. Hits different people different ways, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So you saying about college, where did you go to college?
I went to University of Miami.
Okay. Like Will Smith.
Is that where he went? Yeah, well, in Miami?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I don't think many people know this, but when I actually didn't get into University of Miami the first time I applied in high school. So I went my first year, freshman year, I went to a school in Boca Raton called Lynn University.
It's like a junior college or like?
It's not a junior college. It's okay. A four-year college.
And you just kept applying to U of M?
I applied after that year, yeah.
Okay.
So I went to Lynn University. I got my grades up. I was in the honors program there.
Okay.
Lynn University is a school, I think that they're very well known for their mortuary program and their hospitality, which are two things that I, you know, didn't have any interest in.
Okay.
But I went there as a biology major because I wanted to go to medical school. After really becoming, you know, fixated on health and nutrition and certain aspects of medicine in high school, I went to Lynn University as a biology major, and I was in the honors program. I was doing pretty well, but ultimately I realized that, you know, I didn't want to live out my 4 years there. I didn't want to stay in Boca.
Yeah.
You know, I was, a lot of my friends were underachievers, and okay. I kind of started to realize that, you know, I can be like a little bit of like a sponge in terms of like, I recognized very early on that if I were hanging out with kids who were bad influences on me, that I would start to do things that were like not super great. You know, the stealing in third grade, the cigarettes in 10th grade.
Yep.
Those are perfect examples of that.
Yeah.
And I started to hang around kids at Lynn University. And at that time, I was very interested. I didn't drink. I went through all of freshman year without really having a single drink.
Wow.
I was just, you know, religiously in the gym, working out, supplementing, eating as healthily as I possibly could. And yet at the time, still a lot of my best friends were like smoking weed every day, underachievers.
Yeah. I love that saying that you're the sum of the five people you spend most of your time with.
Yeah, it's so true.
So true.
It's so true. So I knew that I didn't want to like, as much as I kind of like, as much fun as I had and like, you know, I did enjoy being around the people there. You know, I had a good amount of friends. I knew that I wanted to be elsewhere around, you know, people that were more high achieving or had higher aspirations.
So you went to U of M then?
Yeah. Went to University of Miami.
Okay. And how was the rest of the folks there? Is that a place where academics are a priority?
I mean,
you just hear about the football, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's known as a party school, but it's gotten a lot better since the university was formed. You know, it's got some great programs. The business program is excellent. You're around a lot of, you know, I realized that you do a lot of your learning outside of class. And so I wanted to be around people who were from different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And at University of Miami, you could either go, there's like two tracks you could take. You could either go the football route and join a frat and be a part of that like Americana culture.
Yep.
Or you could be a part of the international crowd and make friends with the international kids and take advantage of the fact that Miami is this incredible melting pot. Few people realize this, but per capita, Miami has more immigrants than any city on earth.
Oh, it's, yeah. Like, I love the culture of Miami.
Yeah, it's, the culture is amazing.
Like, you go to Little Havana, or like, you know, the downtown is totally different than Wynwood Arts District.
Yeah, it's just incredible. So I decided almost immediately to really kind of seek out those kids. So I became friends with a Venezuelan. My best friends were like Venezuelan, Moroccan, French, Saudi. And all of our extracurricular activities were like in South Beach at some of these like really high-end clubs that are among the most exclusive clubs in the world in Miami and South Beach. And we were like somehow able as undergraduates to finagle our way in, which in and of itself is a learning expression or a learning lesson. Like we would have this metaphor, me and my friends. So there's a club in Miami, it's called Mint. And we actually called it University of Mint because we figured that if you could figure out a way to get in there and rub shoulders with the people that were at Mint. I mean, this is a very sort of young perspective on it, but that you would learn a lot about life by doing that. And you could probably attest to that, you know, having a background in, you know, nightlife and stuff like
that
as
well. Yeah, I've been to Mint.
Yeah, you've been to Mint. Yeah, so yeah. I kind of, you know, we figured very early on that those would be invaluable skills. Like, if you could get in through that velvet rope.
Yeah.
You could get
it's
past
not easy,
anything.
Man. It's not easy.
It's not easy.
That's why I became a club promoter. I moved to Hollywood, and I couldn't get in anywhere. And I decided to take it from the inside out.
Yeah, it's an amazing metaphor. And lo and behold, you know, we would spend every, you know, multiple nights a week at Mint. You know, we found a way to, you know, we found a way to work ourselves in, and become friends with the owner and the guys at the door, and we'd tip them when need be with our, you know, the limited money that we had as undergraduates on a budget.
We used to do that in Vegas. I remember we'd give them like $5 each to get in the Studio 54.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I learned like a ton about life, about business, just doing that, you know? And then academically, I began, again, I transferred over as a biology major, but then something happened where I realized that I had a love for storytelling and for creativity, and I had sat in on an introductory film course, and I realized that academically, you know, I thought that I wasn't gonna be happy were I to go through that rigorous academic route of, you know, the medical school track and the like, and so I switched to a double major in film and psychology with a focus on documentary filmmaking. And I did that, and you know, that was definitely an easier ride, but I felt that it was a track that would allow me to sort of feel out and navigate the other aspects of life that were interesting to me, you know?
Okay. So when did you move to Hollywood?
So I moved to Hollywood after I graduated from college.
Okay.
And that was because as an undergraduate, as a film major, I made a film that ended up on the desk of the president of programming of a TV network called Current that was launched by former US VP Al Gore.
Yeah.
And so they moved me, they plucked me from college to become an on-air host for Current TV. And I became a journalist and a host for that network.
Wait, because you appeared in your own film? And they're like, "This, we want this guy as a host?"
Yeah.
So you were like scouted.
I was scouted, pretty much. Discovered.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a dream scenario.
Okay, so they like move out to Hollywood and be a host.
Yeah.
So you didn't come out to Hollywood and like have to like schlep around and go to auditions. You just came straight into the fucking Walk of Fame, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so what happened then? Because then you're on TV, right? It was a real TV station?
Yeah, I was on TV. We launched, I think it was August 5th, 2005 was when August 5th, 2005 when the network went live. And from that point on, I was on TV in millions of homes in the U.S.
Oh, wow. Were you hanging out with Big Al a lot, too?
Yeah, I got to see Big Al. Yeah.
Did you guys go kick it?
We'd kick it at the company parties. He'd give me a big hug because I was on camera. So, I mean, even though the company had hundreds of employees.
Yeah, he'd see you.
Yeah, he'd see me. And that was great. One of the faces of his network. So I got to do that. And it was incredible. I covered stories that were funny and topical and serious and about, you know, issues that were in my wheelhouse as somebody who's always been interested in health.
So the show is just like, just what's going on?
Pretty much.
You were just the main show on Current TV, is that what it was? Current, just like...
Yeah, well, the network launched, it was sort of like, they launched with this kind of crazy idea of being like a video... They wanted to be a video iPod on shuffle. So okay. This is when iPods had just come out. Mm. And songs, you could put your iPod on shuffle and you can get a song. And that was like... To have your entire music library on a device. I mean, now we take it for granted, but that was like a very new idea. That's why the iPod.
That's right. You had to carry on the case of CDs.
Yeah, CDs and tapes.
Before that, tapes.
I did that.
So I didn't even carry those things around.
Growing up, yeah. So they wanted to basically provide short form documentaries, like so documentaries that were like a song in length.
Yeah.
To the audience on this TV network on basically like on a randomized shuffle all day. And in and out of those documentaries, I would be like a VJ introducing the documentary.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Setting it up with context, giving a shout out to the creator of the documentary. You know, adding context, sort of like a VJ on MTV, but instead of talking about music videos, I was talking about these short documentaries.
Got it.
And then maybe giving some sponsor information. So like, you know, this doc, this
you're like the Ryan Seacrest.
Yes. Exactly.
You were a DJ.
Yeah.
A VJ.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then at the end I would come out and I would talk about, you know, I would just sort of like give a closing. And that was how it first started.
Okay.
Eventually I would start to talk more about breaking news and more serious, you know, geopolitical news.
So topics. Did you get recognized in public a lot? Like, I'm sure you were, since you were clubbing in Miami, you must have done some, you know, Hollywood nightlife scene.
Yeah.
Would you get recognized? Like, would people your age watch the TV or was it more for older folks?
No, it was aimed squarely at young people. This was before YouTube. So young people didn't really have a place to go and consume.
Did they watch that? Because I didn't watch it. No offense.
Yeah, no.
I never even heard of it until
I was. It was, you know, I think criminally underwatched. But yeah,
Was it on the internet or was it on the
TV?
It was on TV.
Okay. On TV.
But did you get recognized and all that? Like,
I got recognized occasionally, not super frequently, because it was not. They could never really figure out how to market themselves. So yeah, the audience was never huge. But those who did recognize me were hugely passionate about the network and what it was that I was doing. So
got it. Yeah. So it had some super fans that really liked it.
Yeah, and then I just also had like on paper clout in Hollywood. Like everybody kind of knew that I was on TV, that I was working for Al Gore.
So you
I was
get through those press. Ropes.
You get through those ropes. Yeah. So it was actually, it was an amazing sort of like, you know, Hollywood on a silver platter experience.
Yeah. Get to party with any of those Backstreet Boys or Britney Spears?
I got to hang out with celebrities. I became friends with early on Bill Maher.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I became friendly with him.
Oh, nice.
I haven't seen him in a long time, but yeah, we became friendly because of Current. I became friends with a lot of the musicians that I was a fan of growing up.
Oh yeah.
Cause I would bring them into the network. I would like, we got to get this guy in, you know, like,
yeah. And got to get this Nick Carter on there.
Nick Carter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. And other celebs, you know, like pretty, pretty high end people and not just celebrities, but like, you know, CEOs and billionaires and like, you know, people I had the respect from. The, you know, like the TED community.
Because Al Gore is like a force of nature.
Yeah.
And so you were also, in addition to being on TV, you were working with him.
I was associated with him.
That's
and
great.
Then I had this power of being able to like talk about things on TV and give spotlight to things.
Mm-hmm.
So it was amazing. It was amazing. It was, and it was definitely, there was a little dissonance because I wasn't really making any money. I was my salary the first year was $30,000.
Okay.
And then I think it went up to $40,000 or $45,000.
Okay.
The next year.
So not quite like ramen noodles, but you're not exactly like throwing guacamole on the burrito either.
Exactly, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I was like, had a roommate, but, you know, I wasn't doing it for money, and I was like just out of college, so
yeah.
there were no qualms. I was like just super happy to be there, super excited.
So did you ride that ship into the ground?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Then that must have been a tough time.
Yeah, it was a really tough time at the end. So I did that for 6 years. But, you know, as you alluded to, the network really never reached critical mass in terms of viewership. So at a certain point, I realized that my growth there had kind of slowed. You know, I was doing the same thing day in and day out. So as much of a dream job as it was, and the fact that anybody would trade to be in my shoes in a minute, I kind of ceased learning and my... notoriety wasn't like increasing, you know, my visibility wasn't increasing.
This is before followers, right? Or was Twitter around?
Twitter had just launched.
Okay. How many followers did you have on the Twitter?
Very few. And I was like, this is...
But like very few, like 1,000 or like very few?
Probably like 2,000, 2,000 something. Okay. But like to be on TV and to know that you're in 100 million homes.
Yeah.
And then to have 2,000 Twitter followers.
Yeah.
And then to see other...
Like Ryan Seacrest.
Ryan Seacrest
probably
got millions.
super envious.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Ryan Seacrest and be like, yo, fuck that guy?
I don't think I've actually ever met Ryan, but I became friends with his sister.
Okay.
So, all right. Yeah. But But yeah, so I realized that this was not...
He's a nice guy, actually. I met him once. Yeah, nice, yeah. You probably like him.
Seems it. So yeah, so like the fame was sort of like plateauing, and I realized like pretty early on that like that this job, unless I was able to do something to like bring more followers to myself, that this job was going to be just that. It wasn't really setting me up to have a career.
Got it.
Because once that ended, what was I going to I was having these crazy existential thoughts. What was I going to have to do? Like go on auditions? I'm not an actor.
Got it.
You know, or like to host another TV show. I don't want to host a music show. I don't care about celebrity. I don't want to host like a celebrity show. I was always...
There's not that many
I was pre-med
shows.
In college. I was like interested in health and fitness and all this stuff, you know, and to be sort of...
You never planned on becoming a TV host.
No. I never planned on becoming a TV host. Mm. I was just sort of like, I ended up doing it and I was great at it and I loved doing it, but... Once that job ended, there were very limited options for me. And so that really began a period that lasted a couple of years with some spikes, you know, a few dopamine spikes sort of in between. But that there was a period of a few years after leaving Current TV where I was super depressed. Mm. You know, I thought that I basically made a huge mistake by not going into medical school.
Oh, wow. And you were... aging as yeah, well, like 6 years have passed, so you're probably what 30 something at that point.
I was like about 30, yeah. I was like almost
where
you,
then
almost
that's what that weird psychological age where you're like, you know, feeling like you should be doing something with your life,
exactly.
Yeah,
I thought that I had basically no career, and I was starting to think about like, well, am I gonna have to get a job? I'm now in my late 20s, I've never had a resume because I've only been on camera, I'm basically unemployable,
yeah,
you know, for a normal job.
Well, still, you're you know, relatively unemployable.
Still, I'm relatively unemployable. Yeah. and so, yeah, it was that was a hard period.
Oh man.
Professionally.
So then, what did you do to keep the ramen on the table?
Yeah, I mean, I still was able to get a few speaking gigs, you know, here and there, but they were by no means, you know, I wasn't making like huge money from them. I came up with a show, like a digital series in 2013 that I was able to find funding for, and that became very successful. And so I was able to, for that period, so I was able to...
Like a YouTube show?
It was a YouTube show.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was that called?
It was called Acting Disruptive.
What was it about?
So, as I mentioned, I never really cared about celebrity, but having spent a lot of time in Hollywood and becoming friends with a lot of celebrities, and especially celebrities who kind of had an interest in social impact... Because of my position, you know, you like attracts like. I became friends with celebs who had these like tech startups, some of which had like, you know, impact behind their missions. Others were just sort of like really interesting in a time when technology was really sort of coming about. And so the concept for the show that I created was it was going to profile celebrities who or, you know, like A-list actors who weren't just actors, weren't just pretty faces, but also had these entrepreneurial passion projects.
Okay, that's cool. So that sold, put some money on the table.
Sold, put some money on the table.
What happened after that?
And also I had savings from Current. I started to make a little bit more at the end of Current just before I had left. So even though I was getting that salary, I left really to, you know, I could have stayed in that cushy position for a little while longer at least. But instead, I wanted to discover new lands, and I had a little bit of savings. I had a little bit of like a savings cushion.
Okay.
And I made some more, you know, money with this other project. But basically, yeah, I didn't know where the real money was going to come from. And it was sort of in that period when I was like at the sort of nadir, like the low, you know, the lowest level of my like existential career anxiety, that my mom got sick.
Mm.
And so I had that to contend with.
What was the first sign?
So I started to spend more time with my mom when the job at Current ended, because I had been apart from her for so long. I was in LA, she was in New York. And I would notice on those trips to New York that there was something about my mom's just who she was that seemed to have changed. You know, her brain power seemed as if it had downshifted in a way. You know, my mom was a very sharp woman. She ran a business. She, you know, wrangled me and my two younger brothers, you know, three boys, a fourth if you include my dad.
You had to get that computer programming mojo from somewhere too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my mom was a very smart woman, very passionate, always had things that she was, you know, excited about and interested in. And suddenly it seemed as if she had almost overnight like a brain transplant with a much older woman.
Whoa.
So it's not that she had immediate like memory problems. It just, it seemed like her, it's almost like if you, you know, if you have the latest and greatest iPhone, how seamless and fast everything works and moves around.
Yeah.
If you were to trade that suddenly for like the iPhone 5.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was, you know, you would notice things would be a lot choppier and slower.
Yeah.
That's how it felt, you know, observing my mom's response time to different commands. And also in tandem with that, there was a change to her gait, her just her movement pattern. She started to walk a lot slower. Her steps took on, you know, more of a shuffle as opposed to a nice stride. And
how does that make you feel when you see that?
I mean, it made me feel just, at first, I was just bewildered. I don't know. Mm. I didn't know what to chalk it up to. I had no prior family history of any type of neurodegenerative disease, so I didn't know what was going on.
And there's no denial because it's very, very pronounced change.
Yeah. And, you know, I love my mom so much, and you know, the last thing I would ever want would be for her to get sick, you know, any type of illness.
Yeah.
And she was so young. So to have my mom have any kind of like major health scare, I just couldn't, it's not something that I was able to wrap my head around. It took me a few months actually to come to grips with the fact that something was happening in my mom and that I needed to step in and begin to actually take a proactive role in my mom's health.
Mm-hmm.
And this was around that time, professionally, you know, I did this AOL project, but even that to me felt very much like a one-off. So I was still having like all of this career anxiety.
Yeah.
I had signed when I left Current with a major agency, that anybody would love to be signed with, you know, any working, you know, any actor who's just starting out in this town or host, you offer them the opportunity to sign with this agent, they would jump at it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had signed with them easily when I left Current, and they had dropped me.
Okay.
So I was suddenly without an agency. I basically had no career. And my mom started to get sick. So at a certain point, I realized, I was just like, all right, well, F the career. My mom is priority number one. I packed up my LA life, and I moved from LA back to New York. And that, you know, that time was really valuable for me. It allowed me to go with my mom to doctor's appointments and to spend time with her and to see really what was going on.
Mm-hmm. What did you discover?
Well, so, you know, my mom, ultimately, it was at the Cleveland Clinic in, I believe, 2011, where my mom was diagnosed with a neurodegenerative condition for the first time. And this was, again, I had no prior family history of any type of dementia.
Wow.
Most people hear the term dementia, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. These are all neurodegenerative conditions that are very common, exceedingly common, too common today. But most people tend to think of them as old person's diseases, right? Like everybody has a grandparent who's maybe had dementia or Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease. But my mom was not old. My mom was youthful. She had all the pigment in her hair. She had just as much energy as she ever had. But suddenly it seemed like her brain powers was, you know, her brain power was just being strangled.
Wow. I watched that Bill Gates documentary, and they ask him, what's your biggest fear? And he says, my brain stopped working.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Gates has invested a lot in Alzheimer's disease research. But yeah, we should all be afraid of losing our minds. You know, our minds are who we are. We are our brains. And, you know, people like us, millennials, we've invested more in human capital than any previous generation. So the fact that we could ultimately one day succumb to these kinds of brain changes, to me, would be a tragedy on a grand scale. And, you know, and it's not just us. It's our loved ones. It's our parents. It's our grandparents. Why should anybody have to suffer this fate? Those are the kinds of questions that I began to ask when my mom was diagnosed. And that really is what sort of set me off down the path of becoming a career investigator into why this would have happened to my mom, what could be done to prevent it from happening to myself and others that I care about. And so all of those interests and skills and everything that I'd learned about health and journalism, investigating a story, communicating a delicate topic, they all sort of became funneled into this obsession with you know, trying to discover what we could do in our day-to-day lives and our diets to help protect our brains.
So you read all the books, all the studies. And yeah. What was your first offering in this space?
The first thing that I did was, I started reading books, watching TED Talks, reading what's called the primary literature, so peer-reviewed, published research, in some of our most storied academic journals. I became friends with somebody who gave me a university login so I could download the papers, which is not something that most civilians get to do, so I have access to all the scientific journals.
Oh, wow.
Which has been crucial for me. And it's just been like, it was just a journey of like in the privacy of my own home, just like reading and watching anything that I could get my hands on. And ultimately I decided to broaden out my quest for answers and reach out to experts. I sort of had media credentials because, you know, I had just done this web series where I had Jared Leto and all these like major celebs.
So people would answer your emails.
Yeah, people would answer my emails. I had done current TV, so I'd worked for Al Gore. The network, you know, was under watch, but it won an Emmy. So I had kind of clout as a public figure.
Yeah.
Even though I wasn't famous, I was a public figure. And I decided to basically create a movie. To create a documentary, because I thought that this topic, this notion of dementia as a preventable condition, nobody was talking about it before me, except for a few handful academics and scientists and researchers. But in the public sphere, nobody was talking about it.
It just happened if genetics
programmed
wrong or it didn't.
Exactly. Wow. So prior to my documentary, I was actually, and this is very old at this point, but the first piece of press that I had ever gotten was I was featured in the Wall Street Journal. So you can actually find this article. I think the headline was Alzheimer's Prevention for 30-somethings with No Symptoms. That was the headline of the article. Huge idea.
Because nobody that's what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Were you just putting it out there on like Facebook or things like that? Or were you doing another show? Or what were you using to put out your findings?
I became interested in it I started putting out content. So I started putting out content.
On social platforms?
Yeah, on Facebook.
Okay.
And I became friendly with a clinician who focuses on research on dementia prevention.
Okay.
And the Wall Street Journal was doing a story on the clinic, and I became sort of the guinea pig that they featured in the article.
Oh,
that
wow.
Signed up to become a patient in a study in the clinic.
Wow. Okay, so what are some things that you've discovered that everyone should or shouldn't be doing to set themselves up with the best chance of not having degenerative brain disorder?
Well, you know, I think one of the most important things that you could do for your brain health is exercise. People that are concerned about having a genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease, some research suggests that with exercise, 3 to 4 to 5 times a week, you can basically negate the influence that that gene has on your risk.
Really? Just gets rid of the influence?
Yeah.
Wow. Because like use, is it like, does it come up from non-use of your
body?
Well,
it might be that exercise is one of the best ways that you can foster better cardiovascular health.
Okay.
And the brain relies on cardiovascular health. So, I mean, it's been known for a long time that there's an adage that what's good for the heart is good for the brain.
Yeah.
And that couldn't be more true. Because the brain is fed blood and nutrients.
That's right. That's right. So that's what keeps the energy system, the detoxification system, the resting system is all through the heart.
Exactly.
Makes sense.
Exactly.
Okay.
In fact, the memory problems that we associate with typical aging may be from sort of outages along that power network. And if you were to take all the microvessels out of your brain and stack them end to end, they would stretch 400 miles long. So these are like...
It's a lot of... network to cover with
exactly
signals and fluids and
people are familiar with strokes. So when you have a stroke,
what does that mean?
That's a blockage.
It's a blockage.
A major blockage of blood flow to the brain.
Okay.
So you get brain tissue that dies because of a lack of oxygen and fuel. But then there's a condition called vascular dementia, which is a lot less that blockage is a lot less pronounced in vascular dementia. It's more like little tiny blockages, sort of in that network of microvessels, right? But even without the diagnosis of vascular dementia, which is the second most common form of dementia, you can have an impingement in those blood vessels. And the thinking is that that dysfunction could underlie sort of like the mental foibles that we associate with typical aging. So like, you know, an increase of forgetting where your keys are as you get older. You know, everybody kind of knows that their brain's processing speed in their later years isn't what it was in their earlier years. Well, that could be due to reduced blood flow to the brain. So anything that we can do to nurture, you know, that cardio, that network of blood vessels, I think is going to be a good thing.
Okay, so exercise.
Exercise, crucial. Aerobic exercise, I think, is valuable. The World Health Organization recommends 150 minutes a week of aerobic.
I want to know what Max Lugavere recommends.
Yeah. So I...
Do you trust the World Health Organization?
Yeah. I mean, okay. So my primary exercise modality is resistance training, and I try to do resistance training in a way that gives me an aerobic workout at the same time.
Got it. So like intervals or like intervals, you know, lifting weights, but not long breaks in between.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Got it.
Less rest in between sets.
Okay.
So aerobic exercise, what that merely implies is that you're just kind of like turning the volume up a bit on your cardiovascular demand. So we're functioning in a state of aerobic respiration right now.
Getting that body moving, yeah. Yeah. But so, it's low.
Right. So you just want to kind of like increase that.
Okay, got it.
And you can do that, I think, with resistance training too. But with resistance training, you get the added benefit of building strength and muscle. And having more muscle in your body is crucial not only for mobility and being able to exercise, but your muscles are basically like endocrine organs. They help foster hormonal health, insulin sensitivity. They provide a disposal mechanism for eating excess carbs and sugar. And of course, you know, staying more mobile as you age, maintaining muscle as you get older and holding and growing and maintaining muscle becomes more difficult as we get older. So big fan of resistance training. So I'm working out 3 to 4 days a week, if not more.
Okay. Give me some more.
Yeah. High intensity interval training is another, you know, exercise modality that you and I have both done.
Yeah.
That we really enjoy, you know, like swinging those battle ropes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think super great.
So even more intensity.
Yeah.
Like crawling or kettlebell swings.
Yeah.
Things like that.
That's an exercise modality that falls under the umbrella of anaerobic work.
Okay.
And what that does is it basically sends a signal to your genome, essentially. So it's literally talking to your genes in a way that demands that your cells become more efficient in terms of the creation of energy. Because when you do that high-intensity interval training, you're creating a momentary energy crisis, right? When you're swinging those ropes and you can't go any further, or if you're sprinting up a hill or doing AMRAPs, you know, if you're a CrossFitter or burpees, if you do that exercise to a point at which you can no longer proceed, you've created an energy crisis in your muscles where they just can't perform anymore because the demand on them is higher than the amount that they can create with the available oxygen. And so they go to a point at which they start, you know, burning the sugar that's stored in your muscles, but we have a very short-lived sugar supply in our muscle tissue. And so that doesn't last very long. And ultimately what happens is your mitochondria realize that they just can't create enough energy. And so what happens? Well, they destroy old mitochondria, which are perhaps less efficient, and they create new mitochondria. This is a process called mitochondrial biogenesis. So pushing yourself, you know, in your workout, and whatever that means for you is going to be different than what it means for me. This is about the effort put in as opposed to, you know, hard endpoints like speed or distance.
What's a mitochondria?
So mitochondria are basically these organelles. They're like these little structures within your cells that create energy.
So new ones of those
give you
more energy capacity all the time.
Yes.
So if you're pressing yourself by doing these movements that create more mitochondria, that increases your capacity.
Your work capacity, yes.
So then later you can tap into that and go deeper. Would it even translate to say like you're busting your ass on one of these workouts? Or consistently, so you up the capacity, then would you be able to go longer on like writing a paper?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good hypothesis. And yeah, I mean, they've shown that this process, mitochondrial biogenesis, occurs in neurons as well, in brain cells.
So it's all connected.
Yeah. You get more energy capacity, more work capacity in your muscle tissue, makes your brain cells more efficient as well.
Awesome. All right. What's something else we should be doing?
So sleep, you know, we can't have a conversation about brain health without talking about the virtues of sleep.
Yeah.
We now know that when you sleep, your brain is actually cleaning itself of proteins that can aggregate and form the plaques that associate with Alzheimer's disease. And you know, it's remarkable. The system is called the glymphatic system. It's named because
cleaning.
It's sort of cleaning. Yeah, it's like a car wash for your brain every night while you sleep. And this is a newly discovered system, so you know the pieces are still being put together in terms of the science, but we do know that it becomes most active during sleep.
During sleep.
Yeah.
Okay, and you know, some people say they're good on 4 hours, some people say they need 8. I'm an 8-hour guy.
Yeah.
So when I hear those 4-hour people, I feel like they're full of shit, but I don't know, is that like possible that
someone
could be built that they could only need 4 hours of sleep?
See, I think 8 seems to be the sort of magic number that it seems most adults need.
Okay.
If you are only able to get 4, I would look to other areas in your life where you could maybe optimize your sleep to try to expand that a little bit, you know? I know there's this romantic kind of thing that we all have now with like hustling. And I know you've talked about like why you shouldn't actually hustle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll sleep when I'm dead mentality. But sleep is one of the best gifts that you can give for to your brain.
Yeah. I love sleep.
So if you're only sleeping 4 or 5 hours, you know, maybe that works for you. Everybody's different at the end of the day. But I would look to areas where maybe you're having disturbance in your sleep. Maybe, you're affecting unintentionally, perhaps, melatonin release, which is your brain's sleep hormone, and try to find ways of expanding that a little bit, or at least optimizing it, because there's the machinery that cleans out your brain during sleep. You can't cheat that. You can't accelerate it. Mm. So you really want to get that full 8 hours.
Got it.
Yeah.
And I had told you about this tracker I was thinking of buying, and I got my Oura Ring on now, and I've been watching it. And you told me you're not a fan of trackers. Why is that?
Yeah, I think it's just better to, for some people it might be useful. You know, if you think that you're getting really good sleep and the tracker says that you're not, well, then maybe that'll, that's a red flag.
Well, I think it makes it top of mind.
Yeah.
Which is a big step.
And it probably also increases your engagement, around the topic, which I think is cool.
Yes.
Personally, I'm not a fan of it because I think it's important to, we already rely too much on our devices. That's like no secret.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think by having one more device to rely on when we should be sort of cultivating our own internal compass about how things are going in our bodies, how well we're sleeping, to be able to recognize when we've slept well, when perhaps we've not slept as well. I think that's a good intuition to cultivate.
Wow, it's interesting hearing a former computer programmer saying that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I love technology as much as the next person.
Yeah.
And I find myself occasionally overusing it. And I've also used these devices, and I feel like at a certain point, the utility is limited, you know?
Yeah.
There's only so many times where I'm going to check the same app and see how I'm doing. It's more, to me, it's useful at first, and then I kind of like lose utility over it. Or I lose, its utility kind of wanes for me.
Very interesting. So do you use any type of like jogging tracker apps like a Strava or anything like that? I don't know if you're a jogger, but like
no.
Are you to work out or you just full on sixth sense?
Yeah,
intuition?
I mean, I think the one thing that's useful is, well, so I think technology is great. I think, like the new Apple Watch, it has an ability to listen to the noisiness of your environment to let you know when you're in an environment that may be loud enough to harm your hearing. So I think that's really useful.
That's interesting.
That's super interesting. I think getting a sense of heart rate variability can be important. So I'm not like down on technology altogether. I use my iPhone to track my steps. I think generally I look at that. Yeah, I want to be as active as I can throughout the day. I don't want to be stagnant.
Make sure you don't sit around in one place too long.
I look at my iPhone. I aim for about 10,000 a day. Come in under that, and certainly many days I do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't beat myself up over it. But walking is crucially important. Just being less stagnant.
Less stagnant. Yeah,
yeah.
We weren't designed to sit in a cubicle all day.
No.
We were designed to roam.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
And just, even small movements. So, if you don't have access to a gym or, you're in old age, or you work a desk job. I mean, I still want people to know that there is tremendous value to be reaped from a category of activity called non-exercise activity.
Like taking the stairs?
Taking the stairs, walking, dancing, doing dishes, doing your laundry, home chores. I mean, anything other than sitting stationary in front of your couch or computer. So, yeah, just movement is crucial. And it's a major means of dissipating excess energy. So today we see a major problem with, the obesity crisis. Many people are overweight. Just simple movements can soak up a massive amount of calories when it comes to energy. You know, like you eat more energy than you burn throughout the day, you're going to gain weight. It's the second law of thermodynamics, right? But by just moving more throughout the day, these simple, small movements can go a long way towards dissipating that excess energy so that you don't actually gain
weight. Yeah. I keep push-up bars and rings in my office. And that way, when I'm in between work, I can just get a set in, or I do some air squats. And I went to Tony Robbins' conference, The Date with Destiny, that's 6 days long. And the thing that blew my mind about myself during that conference is I'm a coffee guy, 3 shots of espresso every single day, and I've developed the addiction. You were saying you quit coffee. I was envious when you were saying that.
I think temporarily, but yeah, for the time being, I've gone like 3.5 weeks, no coffee. I feel amazing.
Gotcha. So Tony does this thing where every, say, 30 minutes, he has you like get up and dance or stretch or like massage the person next to you. And then the days go 12 hours long. And I was the type of kid in school where this is like before ADD was a thing, but I could never pay attention in class. I was always like drawing or fucking with my neighbor or whatever, you know. And even these days, I'll go to a conference where I'm really interested in the subject matter and I just will be like falling asleep, literally. But I went to this Tony Robbins thing and I was engaged the whole time for like 10 and 12 hours in a row. And I think it's because he has you jumping up and like moving the body, you know? So I try to take that back. And I actually got silent disco headphones in my office. We haven't gotten a consistent thing for that, but I have, you know, a group of people, like 10 of us will come over to my office a couple times a week. We need to be doing it a couple times a day, but a couple times a week, we'll put on the silent disco headphones, we'll put on like Calvin Harris, we'll just bop, 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 just rock out to song, then get back to work. And I feel like so much sharper with no caffeine.
Yeah. Well, your organization relies on the brains of your employees, right? Your company.
Most do, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
all do. Okay, all do. Yeah. When you sit for an extended period of time, it literally causes blood to drain from your brain.
Right, because it's all down here. Yeah. So that should be something, I guess, everyone could apply in their companies, is get the office up and do an hourly movement or stretch or something like that. I mean, we've got a gym in our office with 19 classes a month and or a week, at Zumba and, you know, CrossFit in the middle of the day and all that, you know, which has been a game changer for the office. But now that we're talking, I'm realizing that like that might not even be enough. It seems like it needs to be consistent.
Yeah, I mean, you don't, I believe there was a study that found, I think every 20 minutes, just like 2 minutes of activity is enough to sort of negate the cognitive impact that being sedentary can have on one's cognitive performance.
Okay, so can one just stand up from the cubicle? Like, what could you do every 20 minutes or, you know, like, is it a walk around the office or what?
A walk around the office is totally sufficient. Just walking is great. I mean, just walking creates these micro vacillations in your blood pressure that causes new fresh blood to go up to your brain. So walking is amazing. You can get a treadmill desk if that's within the realm of possibility. You can get a standing desk.
What do you think of those? Do you use one of those?
I have a standing desk.
And do you use it daily?
I use it daily, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, my desk is always in the sort of standing position.
Okay.
And I don't have a treadmill desk, but I do have a device. I have no affiliation with the company, but I really appreciate the device. It's basically a standing mat, but it's not fully flat. It basically has these ridges and valleys. And so you can kind of do calf raises off of it. You can kind of stretch your feet and do some cool things like that. So I'm always kind of like moving my feet around when I'm at my standing desk. And then I take, you know, I'll bring a chair over. I'll maybe like put a leg up and like do a hip stretch or walk around my, you know, my apartment because I work from home.
Yeah.
But generally any movements that you can take that are beyond just like sitting and typing, I think is are going to be worthwhile.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, yeah. So we got exercise. We got sleep. We got not being a lazy fuck during the day, getting up, walking around.
Crucial.
Okay. And Genius Foods is the name of your book.
Yeah.
Tell me how you discovered this way of eating that helps your brain, because I know, you know, I've read the book. I know it helps your brain in the moment, and I know it's long-term preventative, and no one else is talking about this stuff. How'd you discover that, and what are the, like, what's the Genius Foods in a nutshell? I mean, everyone should read this book because it's about your brain and your entire life, but what's a few things that people could do right now, today, with their next meal to increase their brain power?
Yeah, I mean, I think if it had to be boiled down, you really want to focus on two things. Properly raised animal products, so like grass-fed beef, mm-hmm. wild fatty fish, like salmon, mm-hmm. sardines, mackerel.
Yeah.
Pastured eggs.
Pastured eggs where the chickens are roaming around eating bugs,
Bugs and whatever it is that they want to eat. Yeah, the egg yolk literally contains a little bit of everything that is required for healthy brain function. Mm. Everything. Yeah, I mean, when an embryo is developing, the nervous system is the first system to assemble, and that includes the brain. So literally, an egg yolk contains everything that nature has deemed important for the developing brain. It's no wonder an egg yolk contains so much cholesterol in it, which we know that for the vast majority of people now doesn't affect blood cholesterol. But that's because 25% of the cholesterol in your body is in your brain. So the brain is massively concentrated in cholesterol. It makes perfect sense that the egg yolk would be too. Now, I'm not saying you need to eat cholesterol for better brain health. The brain makes all of the cholesterol that it needs. But everything else that's in that egg yolk is of crucial importance. Selenium, DHA fat, vitamin B12, choline. These are all crucial nutrients for optimal brain function.
So an egg a day?
An egg or two or three a day, yeah.
Really, every day? Are you doing this?
Every day. Okay. Yeah. And I'll say that some people, you know, there's a minority of people who are hyper responders, and so they might see a change to their blood lipids by eating more eggs. And so you always want to, you know, you want to get regular sort of labs and things to check up. I think you want to know your numbers.
Okay. What if I want to cheat, but have a healthy cheat, like an Egg McMuffin?
Well, I wouldn't recommend the Egg McMuffin.
That's a serious question.
Man. Yeah.
Because that's the way people think. A lot of times they'll think, oh, I need to eat an egg every day.
Yeah.
Oh, normally I'll do my pasteurized egg, but I'll have Egg McMuffin once or twice a week, just, and I'm still getting my egg.
Yeah.
But it's not the same, right?
It's not the same. Well, so it is a really good question. And I've had, growing up, there were maybe one or two times where I've had Egg McMuffins, and I'll say that they're delicious.
They're fucking great.
They're great.
Yeah.
They're great. They're very sweet, so they're sweetened with maple syrup, and the bread is probably...
In the bread or something?
Yeah, and they're probably loaded with trans fats because, you know, it's commercially produced bread.
Fat.
Yeah, very unhealthy fats. So, I mean, if anything, you know...
And the meat they probably throw on there is probably not...
The best.
The best. Probably unethically raised, too, which I've been trying to eat... ethically raised meat that's on the pasture, like at the farm Bel Campo that we're both fans of.
Yeah. But if it was the only egg available to you in the form of an Egg McMuffin, I'd get the Egg McMuffin without the bread and I would eat the egg and the sausage. And at the very least you're gonna have a low carb, satiating protein meal that's gonna have the nutrients from that egg yolk.
That cheese they put on
that is not my perfect meal, obviously. Okay. But it's, you know, it's if like push came to shove and you were starving.
Maybe have them wrap it in a lettuce or something?
Yeah, perhaps. That's a good idea.
The cheese. What is your take on cheese?
I'm not a fan of processed cheese, so I wouldn't do that.
Okay, so no cheese, just egg, sausage, give me it in a lettuce.
Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds tasty.
Egg McLettuce.
Egg McLettuce.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so you mentioned some animal
products. Those are the animal products, right?
Let's now, talk about veggies, starches.
Yeah, so a lot of people think that I'm like all about the animal products, but I'm actually equally, if not more, excited about plant foods. And I'm not talking about ultra-processed plant food-like products. I'm talking about plants. So dark leafy greens, kale, spinach, arugula, carotenoid-containing plants. So avocados would be an amazing source. Bell peppers, things like that.
Okay.
I'm a huge fan of those, and research shows that people who eat a large bowl of dark leafy greens tend to have brains that perform younger by up to 11 years.
Mm.
So every day, one of the rules that I lay out in my book, Genius Foods, you want to have a big fatty salad, just a big ass salad every day.
Yeah.
Filled with dark leafy greens and a nice fat source, like extra virgin olive oil. It's my favorite fat source.
Avocado would be another?
Avocado would be another great one.
Okay, so dump on that olive oil. So, yeah, I dump olive oil on almost everything I eat now since I've been following Dr. Gundry's philosophy, which I want to ask you about too. But
yeah,
big old fatty salad.
Yeah.
One a day good, or should you have greens with every meal?
I mean, you could have vegetables with every meal, but I like to do the salad just once a day, whether that's at dinner or lunch. And you can have it sort of, you can make that your primary meal, the big salad, or you can have it on the side. But I think having at least a cup of dark leafy greens every day is crucial.
Okay, and you mentioned bell peppers, which is a nightshade that contains lectins, which Dr. Gundry and other folks say are people should consider avoiding.
Should limit, I think the concern really is in the seeds of the bell peppers.
Yes, the seeds and the peel, I believe.
I don't know about the peel of bell pepper.
Tomatoes. What are your thoughts on lectins, just in general?
I'm not super concerned for the average person. I think that there are some people who have autoimmune conditions, and I think that for those people, cutting out, and of course, if you're overtly sensitive, nightshades and lectins could potentially be helpful because these proteins initiate something in the body called molecular mimicry, and they could sort of exacerbate a confused immune system. And a confused immune system, we'll just say for our definition, is an immune system that has begun to attack the host. So for people with autoimmune conditions, I think that maybe that's something that you could try eliminating to see if it helps your symptoms. But for most people, I don't think that cutting out tomatoes, bell peppers, and things like that is going to be... I don't think that the benefits are going to outweigh the risks. I think that the benefits of those foods are numerous. Tomatoes, you have a powerful antioxidant called lycopene. In bell peppers, you've got those carotenoids that I was talking about. You've got another compound called luteolin, which has been shown to be beneficial to brain health. Nightshades are, they actually have, very few people realize this, but all nightshades contain nicotine. They're all a natural source of nicotine.
Wow.
Tobacco itself is a nightshade. And nicotine actually in tiny, tiny amounts, it's not going to make you addicted to bell peppers, but it might actually have a cognition boosting effect.
Okay. What are your thoughts on the Juul?
Like the vaping thing?
Yeah.
Definitely not good for you.
Yeah, but it's pure nicotine, right?
Yeah. Probably a very high dose of nicotine meant to get you addicted to the Juul.
You think it's too high? Because there's talk that nicotine itself isn't bad for you, that it's this the tar and all that shit from the tobacco. Yeah.
I wouldn't go out of my way to get more, like to get isolated nicotine, because I feel like it would addict you to the product, and I don't know.
But you feel it's a good thing if you're getting it from a food source.
Potentially, yeah.
Potentially.
But I don't think
you wouldn't just hit it.
Well, I don't think it's any better than any of the other important compounds that we get from plants, polyphenols and, carotenoids and vitamins and minerals and things like that. But I think it's like, it's just interesting to bring up.
Yeah. Okay. How about ketamine?
Ketamine would not mess with. Although there are clinical trials now being performed with ketamine as a treatment for major depression. So under appropriate set and setting with a trained professional, I think ketamine, there's a lot of sort of exciting stuff.
Is there any relation between those two, or do they just happen to rhyme?
Ketamine and nicotine?
Nicotine, yes.
I'm not sure about, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. You always, as a scientist, you have to learn when to say you don't know. Because, I mean, I definitely don't know everything.
Right.
I don't even know half of everything. Like, my wheelhouse, I became really focused on, my goal is to become a sort of walking meta-analysis for what we know about how to prevent Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And under that purview, you have fitness, you have gut health, you have sleep, you have cardiovascular health, you have, all these different sort of, these components, but really for me, it's like the North Star for me is just seeing what it was that my mom went through, due to her brain not working the way that it should have been working, at her age. And people ask me questions like about, many different aspects of medicine at this point. And, I have to remind them, I'm not a medical doctor.
Right.
I just became really passionate about this topic because the information was available to me. My mom was sick and I just went all in.
Love it. So I want to make sure you didn't miss any big categories. Yeah. We got sleep, exercise, movement, and we covered food.
Yeah.
Is there any other big categories that people should be looking into? Like maybe, there's a lot of buzz about like avoiding blue light these days and things like that? Or is that more related to sleep or anything else big that people should be doing to optimize brain health right now?
Yeah, so that, is crucial. I think avoiding blue light at night, so minimizing your use of smartphones.
For sleep or for your brain health in general?
For sleep.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not like a new category. It's more like if you're...
Yeah.
...as under things to do in the sleep.
Well, and it also relates to your body's circadian rhythm. So circadian biology is now a major, aspect. We're learning that, all of our genes and every organ in the body essentially responds to cues that let those cells or those organ systems know what time of day it is. And we're just at the tip of the iceberg in terms of understanding the full implication that this diurnal pattern, the sun comes up in the daytime, it recedes at night, has on our brain health and our brain function. But, for example, we know that the brain is cleaning itself during sleep, so we don't want to impede on that process by doing things or by exposing our body to stimuli that might otherwise make it think that it's daytime. So, wearing blue light blocking glasses at night, that's definitely, I would say, but I would put that under the sleep category. Stress management is crucial. We didn't talk about that. You want to avoid chronic stress to the best of your ability. Everybody has only so much stress that they can contend with. And today we're seeing, record rates of burnout. People are more interested than ever in ways of mitigating anxiety and things like that.
Are you a meditator?
I meditate on occasion. I don't have a regular practice.
Do you wish you did, or do you feel like that's something everyone should do?
I wish I did.
Haven't been.
I wish I did. I know you have a regular practice. I wish that I was a regular meditator. I just don't have the discipline yet. But I, meditation is really, it's wonderful, and so I would recommend it to everybody. And I would say get trained. It's crucial.
And I know you like cryo.
Yeah.
You like getting in the cold cold tank. For those of you guys who haven't seen cryo, you get in this freezing cold tank for 3 minutes?
About 3 minutes. I also like ice plunges, which I know that you're a big fan of.
Yep.
Now, also really good for dialing in mental acuity.
Okay.
Bolstering the metabolic health of the body, which affects the brain in a very powerful way. The metabolic health of the body affects the brain's metabolism. We believe, because there's this relationship that we see, an inverse relationship between a direct positive relationship between the metabolic health of the body and the brain's ability to create energy. So,
and have you seen this light therapy thing where you stare at a light? Red light or something like that?
Yeah.
There's one called the Juve, I believe.
Yes.
You've seen it?
I have a lot of friends who are interested in that. I'm not well-versed on the science of that.
How about infrared sauna or sauna in general?
Sauna in general is great. Yeah.
Yeah,
so there's a lot of research now coming. Yes.
You do it pretty regularly, right?
I do it regularly. Yeah.
Regular sauna or infrared?
Well, I'll do both depending on what's available to me.
Okay.
But my preference is for regular sauna because.
How often?
I try to do it 3 to 5 times a week.
How long?
For about a half an hour. But
now,
up until.
Dry sauna or steam?
Dry.
Okay.
Dry.
Is that important?
Steam is hypothetically going to be just as good for you, but it's not the modality, it's not the sauna form that's been studied where they're putting out all the research at the University of Eastern Finland showing us that routine sauna use is associated with better cardiovascular health, dramatically reduced risk for dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and even early mortality. So,
so this is proven.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, those are observational
good
studies.
Science. Good science.
Very good science.
Okay, gotcha.
A strong supportive body of evidence. And again, saunas are great for cardiovascular health. They sort of serve as an aerobic exercise mimetic. So you're basically getting a workout just sitting in your sauna. You sweat all kinds of heavy metals and environmental toxins out of your skin, which is a detox organ in and of itself. So I'm a huge sauna fan.
Why doesn't anyone do any of this shit? Everyone knows that you shouldn't eat McDonald's. Everyone knows that you should be exercising every day. You just gave a few other amazing things to optimize.
Yeah.
What's your suggestion to people to get off their ass and actually do this stuff? What's worked for you? Because you said you there was a time in high school when you weren't in the best shape. And I know you do some, you have some clients that you work with. And of course, you put out amazing content on your socials. What do you tell people to just get them in gear?
Yeah, it depends where you're coming from. But most of the time I say, don't wait until you get sick. Don't wait until a loved one gets sick for you to take charge of your life. Usually when you see people turn their health around, it's because they've had a big health scare.
Yes.
Right? That's the number one reason why people, get engaged with health and wellness. But don't wait for that. Because a lot of the time, in the vast majority of cases we see, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Because these conditions take years, if not decades, to develop. Alzheimer's disease takes 20 to 30, if not more, years to...
Really?
Yeah, to develop before
you... So you got to start now to start...
You got to start now. And and by starting now and embracing these modalities, you know, this is not just a long-term investment. I know you like to talk about investments, you know, and getting a good ROI, right,
yep,
on your investment. This is not just a long-term investment. So this is not just like locking your money up for 20 to 30 years. This is like putting your money into an account that's going to not only pay off in 20 to 30 years, but you're going to get a massive dividend
every day. Love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
do this shit. You're going to feel the immediate benefit. And then, you know, however many years from now, you're still going to be going. Well, the people who are around you who didn't put in that work every day are going to be slowing down.
Exactly. Well
amazing.
Said.
Amazing. So, Max, your book, Genius Foods, came out, blew the fuck up. So exciting to see that thing go. How many copies is it sold now?
Oh, man. I think we've sold like almost 200,000.
That's so amazing, man.
Yeah.
And Genius Life is coming out soon. People can find you on the gram, maxlugavere.com. Is that the best place to follow you to get the majority of your content, or where else? How does someone get on your email list? Because you drop these great emails.
Yeah. So, I mean, Instagram, I'm super active on Instagram. And then if you want to join my newsletter, all you got to do is go to maxlugavere.com.
Okay.
Enter first and last name. Immediately upon joining, you're going to get my number one sleep hack.
Okay. Spell your last name now for people who are just on audio that are listening that want to put it in their phone right now. M-A-X.
L-U-G-A-V-E-R-E.
One more time.
L-U-G-A-V-E-R-E.
Awesome.
So, yeah, sign up for that.
Do that. Get on Max's newsletter. It's lit AF.
AF.
And so has been this interview. Thanks, man, for diving in. This has been really great.
Yeah, dude.
And we're going to do this again because we got so much more. We've only scratched the surface on all the amazing stuff that Max has to share. So if you are super geeky, AKA super smart about taking care of this thing up here, be ready for the next episode because we'll get even deeper into some of the things we talked about, other foods you can eat, other exercise routines, ways to optimize sleep. I'm going to ask Max more pressing questions about his dating life. Maybe we'll find some more embarrassing stories of him hanging out with French men, listening to the Backstreet Boys, wearing Dolce & Gabbana. Who knows? But thanks for being here, man.
Dude, real pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks so much for tuning in. I want to know what you thought of this episode. Tell us in the comments below. I want to know what the highlights were. If this sparked a memory of a story that you've gone through, I want to know about that. So let me know in the comments below. I read every single one. I respond to as many as I can. And hey, if you're just here to talk shit, bring it on. Drop it in the comments below. I like the shit talkers too. You're building my algorithm. So speak up.